You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 236 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Batman the Detective number 1, The Joker number 2, Rorschach number 7, Batman Urban Legends number 2, Superman number 30, Wonder Woman number 770, Batwoman season 2 episode 10, Time Off for Good Behavior, Black Lightning season 4 episode 7, Painkiller, Supergirl season 6 episode 3, Phantom Menaces, and Flash season 7 episode 7, Growing Pains. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, first up for DC News, Dominic Purcell, Heatwave from Legends of Tomorrow, posted something on Instagram, and DC, or the comic book news people, went freaking crazy, because he said he was leaving the show, but we had announced that months ago, and I thought that was crazy that the news outlets were going crazy about it, because it was already announced.
I'm short memory, I guess, or hoping to get a second hit on the news cycle. Not him, obviously, but the people reporting it. I agree with you. That's odd because we've known about that for a while.
Yeah, and I don't know. His Instagram post made it sound like he was mad at the studio or something. But then he deleted that post and then came back with something like he was talking about messing with the news, the comic news people.
I mean, the guy was barely on the show to begin with, and it didn't seem like he was dissatisfied with that. It seemed like that was like the perfect gig. They're just handing him a bag of cash every week for him to film like one scene. I would have been pretty surprised if he had had some, not that it's impossible for him to have had gripes, but I feel like of anybody on Legends in the last few seasons, he's not the one I would pick that had a gripe. I think it would be one of his taller castmates.
Yeah. All right, and for our second bit of DC news, the next Batman, the digital comic series, has been coming out for the last several weeks, but I didn't know it because DC hasn't been posting it on their website. That's where I go to find out what comics and stuff are coming out. So I was kind of ticked off at them because now we're several issues behind. I put it on our schedule for next week. We're going to review issue number 2. But I'm a little ticked off at them for not having it posted on their website because they always posted Sensational Wonder Woman on there. So I was a little teed off about that.
Yeah, that's odd. I wonder if it just did so poorly that they're basically just like putting it out there just to burn it off. This is pure speculation on my part. That's just odd. That's so odd that you wouldn't promote a comic, even if it's digital only. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, it didn't make any sense to me. So we will get back on track with that, but we'll be behind. So that's just how it's going to be. The other thing that I'm not happy with DC is they haven't said anything about Sensational Wonder Woman. We've been reviewing that for weeks, and all of a sudden there was not another issue, and I haven't heard anything about it. So I don't know where we're at with that. I hope it's not done.
I wonder if these digital comics are getting lost in the shuffle with all of the new power restructuring going on there. I mean, again, I this is purely speculation on my part, but it's just a guess because I never really felt like they promoted Sensational Wonder Woman that much. You know, it just kind of was out there. Honestly, I thought the Adventures Continue, based on the animated series, I didn't think that that had any real promotion to it either. I feel like they've got these digital first series that are not bad. I don't remember the next Batman vividly, but I remember it not being, you know, terrible by any means. So I don't know what they're doing. Like, they're putting out at minimum these decent comics that are better than some of the paper comics they're putting out.
That is true. Yeah, so just a little rant I wanted to have.
I think that's totally fair. I think it's a fair. I don't. Why wouldn't you? Again, you don't need to like go crazy on a, you know, spending spree to advertise for these things, but you know, letting people know that they exist would be a good start.
Yeah, and when you put it on your website, that's, you know, doesn't, it's not going to cost you that much ever extra for putting it on there.
And if we're being honest, burying the next Batman like that is not a great look. you've got the, you know, a black Batman, and you're trying to make news with that, and then you turn around and just do, you know, don't even let people know that his book is still being published. Like, that's not great.
No, it's not. So, but we will be checking out issue number 2 next week, and then we'll just have it on our schedule every week, and we'll just be behind on it, I guess. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
I'm Tony Heath.
And we host the Watchathon of Rassilon,
a podcast where we watch every episode of Doctor Who and then talk to you about it.
It's like an idiot's guide to Doctor Who.
And we're the idiots.
The Watchathon of Rassilon, a Doctor Who podcast made by idiots.
And a proud member of the ESO Network.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you.
For you.
All right, let's talk Batman, the Detective Number 1. The issue opens up on Wayne Airlines Flight 89 from Gotham to London. The flight attendant counts the passengers and everyone is accounted for. She goes to a storage cabinet and puts on a Batman mask. She states this is because of Batman, and both her and the pilot jump from the plane. Burrell Hutchinson, a.k.a. Knight, tries to stop them. She gets pulled out of the plane with them. We see the plane crashes, and then a message is left on the side of the building that says Batman 147. We see that Batman is lonely after the death of Alfred, and there's no family for him in Gotham. He decides to leave the Batcave forever. Batman goes across the pond to investigate the plane crash. He meets up with the new squire, who's Knight's sidekick. We see that the gentleman ghost shows up, but he's changed. He's no gentleman. He's some sort of monster. And he needs to feed on fear. And he's here because 146 people died in absolute terror. When Gentleman Ghost tries to feed off Batman's fear, Batman punches him with special gloves he got from John Constantine. Batman visits Burrell, a.k.a. Knight, in the hospital. Batman tells Burrell that he is cross-referencing the passenger list. As he is doing that, hostiles have come for Burrell, and more people in Batman costumes. Batman is able to take a hostage and frighten the rest of the group away. Batman discovers that all the passengers aboard, every one of them, had been once rescued by Batman. Now I gotta ask you, Cletus. I'm guessing that Knight and Squire were part of Batman Inc.
I'm pretty sure. I can't say for certain, but I'm pretty sure they were.
Okay, I wasn't familiar with these characters because Batman Inc. was during the period when I wasn't reading comics, so I wasn't sure. But it felt like that to me. Now, the story itself seemed to indicate that it took place after the Joker War because Alfred is dead, yet Batman has lots of gadgets and stuff he seems to be using, and it doesn't feel like he's lost his money. So I'm guessing this story is not in continuity, but it doesn't really have to be, honestly.
Yeah, I don't think it is, because I got the sense that he was a little bit older, too. Also, way bigger. It's all personal tastes. I was not a huge fan of the art style. Not that it was bad art by any means, but it's just not my taste. I don't need a Batman that looks like Bane.
He was jacked up pretty good. I noticed that too.
It was just, again, it all comes to personal taste. So I am sure there's some people that they really like the artists in his style for this, and that's fine. Again, it is not poorly drawn. It's just not my cup of tea. I don't really care for, Bruce was ridiculous. He was like, he looked like he was supposed to be, you know what I mean? Like maybe upper 40s, and yet was just absolutely jacked.
He definitely was. Gentleman Ghost was weird in this story too. I've never seen a version of him like that before.
Yeah, it was kind of, I thought the thing that I think the art felt incongruous to me personally was because it felt like it was going for like sort of classic 90s extreme, like look how beefy Batman is and look how, you know, scary and intense and extreme Gentleman Ghost is. And it's just like, but the story itself wasn't that. You know what I mean? Like that was the thing that felt a little odd, is that the art seemed to be like classic over the top 90s, but the story was not that. And so they just didn't seem to match up with each other to me personally.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. Now that you're pointing it out, I didn't pay that a close enough attention to it being in, you know, conflict with each other, but that does make sense.
I enjoyed the art wasn't, it didn't take me out of the comic. I enjoyed this. I'm pretty interested in the story. I just personally thought that there are definitely Batman comics that we've read that this art style would fit. And it just was, to me, it wasn't this story. This story seemed a little more subdued than the style that it was being drawn in.
I was kind of curious about the plot itself, because I was wondering, how does killing people that Batman has rescued in his past benefit the villain? Is he trying to undo Batman's accomplishments? And while I was thinking about it, what villain would want to do that? And it made me, the villain that popped in my mind was Ra's al Ghul. And I was wondering if that's what you felt like the villain might be behind this, or if it was something totally different.
That's a good guess. I don't know. I think there's a number of Batman villains that would do this. He has a thing for psychopaths. So I mean, it's not Hush, but like Hush could totally, I could see him doing that.
Yeah. Okay. I was just curious, but that's the feeling I got. So we'll see if I'm right or wrong.
I think that's a really good guess. I don't really know. I think there's a number of candidates, but Roz is as good a guess as any.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. The Joker number 2. Jim Gordon contacts Batman with a makeshift bat signal. Jim tells Batman about the woman in the limousine, Joker going to Belize, and then the $25 million to go after him. Of course, Jim leaves out the part about killing Joker. Jim has called Batman because he needs his help. Batman explains he can't leave Gotham right now because of the Arkham incident and the chaos it's produced. Jim states he needs to access the Bat computer's information on Joker. Jim wants Batman to find out who hired him, and Jim also wants to be able to reach Batman without having to use a bat signal. Batman has some conditions also. When Jim finds Joker, he calls in Batman. Jim doesn't go for the capture by himself. Now, Batman calls in Oracle, and Oracle points out she thinks this is a stupid idea. She also points out to Batman that Jim didn't promise to let Batman bring in the Joker. And to distract Batman from that fact, Jim reveals to Oracle that he knows she's Barbara, and Barbara tells Jim to come to the clock tower now. We see Joker is relaxing at a resort, when he's asked to leave because he's killed one of their wealthiest neighbors. Joker ignores their suggestion to leave and demands 30 armed men and a plane to get out of there when he's ready. Joker has a plan because he knows he's being tracked. Jim and Barbara talk. Barbara tells Jim that she's been overtaxing her implants the last few years. If she pushes it too far, it might not be effective any longer. And she says there is a bit of a timer on being Batgirl. Barbara also brings up the fact that a few months ago, Jim told her that Batgirl was going to be held accountable for what happened to her brother James. Now, Jim tells her that he's sorry for that. He was just lashing out. Next,
false.
Jim... What's that?
False. I know that that's what the story says, but that is absolutely a retcon.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I have to agree with you totally on that. Next, Jim tells Barbara that he was hired to kill the Joker. Barbara tells him that he doesn't need the money, and he could sell a book about his dealings with Batman and make millions. Barbara tells Jim she is not going to help kill Joker, but Jim makes a deal with her. Jim will only go through with killing Joker if he can convince Barbara that it's the right thing to do. Now, Barbara thinks that this woman, Cressida, has her own ties to Arkham, and this might be retaliation for what Joker did to Arkham. Towards the end of the issue there, we see three different groups who are going after Joker. In Hooper County, Texas, Billy Sampson was killed in Arkham and his family wants revenge. In Santa Prisca, we see some group of Bane masks wearing people create a new female Bane to go after the Joker. And then we find out Cressida has restored her family's name and is now has a seat on the Court of Owls. So it's the Court of Owls who've hired Jim to kill Joker.
So I had a couple. I have several thoughts on this issue. One, I do think it's really interesting that this is really a Jim Gordon comic, but they knew that that probably wouldn't sell, so they called it Joker. I admire that.
Didn't I? I think I stated that last episode that when it came out, I wasn't happy. Wasn't really happy about a Joker story, but when we actually checked it out, it was about Jim Gordon. So this is definitely that.
Yeah, well, and if there was any doubt from the first issue if it was going to start paying more attention to Joker, I think this issue clarified what it really is. And which, to be clear, I think is better. I think this is a better route than making it about the Joker, because I think if you focus on the Joker too much, I think you kind of lose something that makes that character work. That, and again, that's just subjective. Some complaints I had with this comic. Overall, I thought it was fine. I hate the retcon to have Jim know that Barbara's Batgirl. Come on. Like, I'm sorry, but the stories that we read, that doesn't make sense. It does not make sense that he knows that Batgirl is his daughter. He absolutely would not have acted that way. And to try and lie to our faces and be like, oh, yeah, I knew, I was really just mad at myself. Come on. I would have preferred, Drew, if they had just not mentioned it at all and essentially just looked at you and been like, yeah, that never happened. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
I think that would have worked. Like, if you're going to acknowledge that twist doesn't make sense, then don't do it. I think you just kind of have to own it and be like, nah, those stories that you read where that doesn't make sense, we're not going to acknowledge that they happened, so it makes sense. I truly think that's the better play. I really do. When you call attention to stories like the one that we just read, it doesn't make sense. He absolutely does not know that his daughter is Batgirl in that comic.
Exactly. And I agree totally with you because that just wouldn't make sense.
They pretty strongly implied that he knows that Bruce is Batman. In this, they just didn't come out directly and say it, which makes me think we may get that reveal later, or they're just going to leave it like strongly hinted at. But I think you kind of lose something. Like, if you bring him fully in the circle, so to speak, knowledge wise, he becomes less of like what's meant to be an outside ally, right? He just becomes a part of the inner circle.
Right.
I guess maybe you could make an argument that he is, but I've always felt to me that the sort of relationship with him is that he's definitely an ally, but he's not on the inner circle. Like, there's always been a little bit of a wall between him and the Bat family, not in a negative way, but just, you know, again, kind of separating the two worlds. And when you get rid of that, and you kind of like, he clearly knows who everybody is, then what are we even like, why are we even bothering with him being a detective at that point? You know what I mean? Just slap him in a suit, which he's done before. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah, I see what you mean with that. And I've always liked Jim better when he didn't know Bruce was Batman and Barbara was Oracle, because we've seen those stories before that he's known. So that's nothing new.
The other thing that this isn't anything wrong with this specific issue, but I'm worried about my personal enjoyment of the conclusion of this comic as a whole is going to be I am anticipating it being completely ridiculous. The Joker is alive at the end of this comic. I hope I'm wrong about that, but I anticipate strongly that I'm going to feel really frustrated that they're essentially going to paint Joker into the corner and then just let him get away at the end. And it's not going to make any sense. And I know that that's going to frustrate me. Like, I'm pre-frustrated right now.
Okay, so we, by the end of the story, we should expect a Cletus rant.
Again, to be clear, I understand not killing the Joker. I get it. I know why you won't do it. I understand. You're a business. Why the hell would you kill the Joker? He's one of your most popular characters. I get it. But if you're not going to do it, which of course you're not going to do it in a continuity, it appears to be a continuity story, then why tell the story? That's the thing. I know I've ranted about stories like that where, like, we know, you and I both know reading that the status quo that they're hinting could happen has no chance in hell of actually happening. Why is that a story in the first place? Like, we're just wasting our time.
Yeah, unless they decide to kill him and then bring him back. That could be a possibility too. Something we've seen before also.
You know what I mean? Like, best case scenario, Jim thinks he's dead and then he's not really dead. We get like a hand popping up out of the rubble at the end of the comic, which is so predictably cliche. It's basically the same as not killing him at all. Again, I'll wait and see how this comic goes. I would very much like to be pleasantly surprised. I am not anticipating that being the case.
All right. We also had a Punchline backup story in this. We see a lot of online reaction to Punchline, good and bad. We see at Snyder College, Harper Row, as Bluebird tracks down Punchline's high school friend, Aiden Priest. He brings Bluebird to some basement where we see a lot of Joker stuff. And then in prison, the Queen of Spades brings Grace Boleyn, better known as Orca, who apparently is the Ace of Spades in the Royal Flush Gang. Not really much happened in that backup story.
No, it was kind of a waste of time, frankly. And also, much like the main comic did, it got me pre-frustrated for the inevitable Punchline inexplicably gets out of another situation. Just like we talked about it, the last Punchline issue, where she just waltzes into the cell and beats the crap out of the crime boss there and gets away with it with no consequences. And that drove me bonkers. And you know that the similar thing is going to happen next issue, Drew. We both know that Orca is not going to win that conflict.
Nope, because this is not going to happen.
It's not. It's just, and again, I'm already frustrated about that because she's a normal girl. I know they've already done the typical CW thing where anybody who puts on a costume inexplicably becomes like one of the top 100 hand-to-hand combatants in the world. So I know they've already done that with her, where she is, again, inexplicably skilled at hand-to-hand combat with no explanation for how that's possible. I accept that, though. I can accept that she is a far better fighter than she has any right to be. It still doesn't make sense that she's going to win that fight next issue.
Nope, it doesn't. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Rorschach number 7. All right, Cletus, I had a lot of trouble trying to sum this issue up, so I'm going to need your help on this. one of the biggest problems I had was at the beginning of the issue, we see that the detective goes into that guy's house that has the Rorschach mask. Who the heck is that? I don't even know that is.
It's Frank Miller.
That's Frank Miller with the mask on?
Yes.
That's why I was so confused the whole time. I couldn't figure out who it was. So that was Frank Miller. Okay. Yeah. And I know the issue talks about this group of comic writers and artists coming together and having this seance and stuff. And I know Tom King was trying to relate it to comics and stuff, but it was hard for me to try to summarize this thing up. So wanted to get your take on it.
Yeah. So, well, one of the things that we know, we had seen the detective, effectively the main character of this book, or at least the one that we've seen the most, had gotten this tape, right? We had already listened to the tape of this seance before where people identified themselves. There's Will, who was the Rorschach that got killed at the beginning of the comic. There's Otto Binder, who is a real-life comic artist / writer, maybe just writer, I can't remember, who really did work on Captain Marvel, as they mentioned in this comic. Frank Miller, again, we all know, real comic creator, is in that seance. And I think there was one other person, I can't remember, but at least those three. So we had heard that tape before, but then we actually see the event happen where Otto Binder's daughter dies. He becomes obsessed with aliens and the idea that these tapes, that if you record it, you can listen back and hear a voice talking to you, theoretically saying what the dead person that you're trying to communicate with is trying to tell you. And we, the readers, every time we see that tape be played, we just see effectively just static, right? We just see white noise.
Right.
But Otto is convinced that he hears the hill is the task, is what he hears in the static. And he's convinced that his daughter's buried on a hill, so he knows that he should go visit her grave. Then, and again, we're not getting this all in chronological order necessarily. The comic starts with the detective visiting Frank Miller, who, like you said, is dressed as Rorschach now. But again, chronologically, we see the original taping of this. Then we see Will Meyerson as Rorschach with the cowgirl go visit Frank Miller, who's, you know, just living in his house, living a normal life as Frank Miller, creator of the Dark Fife instead of the Dark Knight. And they listen to the tape again. And this time when they hear that, instead of hearing the hill is the task, Will, who we see has been listening to this tape for years and years and years and has never really heard anything, now hears the will is the mask, meaning he's supposed to be Rorschach. That's how he interprets that. And then shortly after that, they go back out on their way. And it seems within a month or two, the assassination attempt from the beginning of this comic starts and Will is killed. They left the tape with Frank Miller, who has now listened to the tape a bunch, and he plays it for the detective. And at the end of the comic, we see what Frank Miller has now he's gotten the phrase from the tape. And it says to kill Turley, the other presidential candidate running against Redford. So we can see that he has now essentially taken up the crusade from Will Meyerson.
Thank you. Oh, man, that makes total sense now. I'm glad you went over that. I just had trouble following it, I guess. Of course, the big piece there, Frank Miller being in the Rorschach mask. I couldn't figure out who was in the mask. I guess that's what kind of threw me off the whole issue. And I even tried to go back to the issue before and figure it out, and it just didn't click.
Yeah, it's just essentially, in terms of the present day, what happens is the detective goes to Frank Miller's house because that's who sent him the letters that he had read, I believe, last issue.
Okay.
So that's who he got the letters from. So he goes to see Frank. When he gets there, he finds out Frank is now dressed as Rorschach. And at the end of the comic, Frank tells him, essentially telling him, I've got to kill Turley. So we'll see where it goes from there.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Very interesting. And now that I know who's behind the mask, and that all makes sense. So interesting that we brought in real comic book characters for this. I actually read a news article or something that I wish I would have saved it, that said that this comic was based off of a real story from Frank Miller or something.
I don't know. I would like to read that article. I have not seen that.
Yeah, I'll have to find it. And if I find it, I'll post it on our Facebook group. But yeah, because I was trying to find something that said who was wearing the Rorschach mask, and I didn't. But yeah, if I find that article.
I would very much like to see that article. Yeah, because one of the things I found really interesting in this issue that you may not have because you didn't necessarily know who was talking was the fictional Frank Miller talking about growing up reading this sort of what we would have thought Pontius Pirate, who is the comic character that Will Meyerson created in this, right? The hugely famous comic character. Everybody loves him. In a sense, Batman, right? I mean, it's basically Batman.
Yeah.
But like a fun-loving Batman, the 50s, 60s Batman, both TV and the comics, right? Not as serious. And then Frank Miller goes to create the Dark Fife, or Fife, I'm not sure how you say it. I think Fife, who's a pirate, but it's serious. Again, and it's the Dark Fife Returns, which again, it's the Dark Knight Returns. So it's exactly what he did in real life with Batman. But it's really interesting because the fictional version of him in this goes on to say, but then after the squid attacks, I kind of realized how silly that was, that it was what Will was doing with Pontius Pirate was, I thought what I was doing with the Dark Fife Returns was more real, more serious. And then the squid attacks happened, and I realized that the more real thing was actually what Will was doing, that giving kids joy and giving them something to imagine and identify with was more important than writing a dark, gritty, serious story. And I thought that was so interesting. And I had a hard time believing that King would just put those words in Frank's mouth. You know what I mean? So it made me feel like there was maybe an interview or something that was based off of, because it seemed, it's certainly possible. I mean, I'm not going to say that Tom wouldn't do that necessarily, but I would be surprised if that speech wasn't based on something that Frank has actually said. And I'd be very curious to see the comparison between the fictional version of Frank that we get in this and obviously the real life comic creator, Frank Miller, whose Dark Knight Returns was this huge turning point in comics history. I mean, that's a big, comics changed pretty noticeably following the Dark Knight Returns. So interesting. I very much enjoyed the metafictional aspect of this, where it's kind of talking about real comics history while being about this completely fictional world.
I agree. I was trying to find that article, but I'm not finding it, so I'll probably have to look for it after the show. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman Urban Legend number 2. First story is Red Hood and Batman Cheer Part 2. Red Hood calls Barbara because he's killed Tyler's father, Andy, for being a douchebag, and now he's freaking out. In a flashback scene, Jason Todd gets money from his mom to buy bread. As he's leaving, he runs into his mom's drug dealer. Jason tells him to bleep off, and the guy pulls a gun on Jason. If you want to talk tough, you better back it up. Now, Batman gets a call from Oracle while he's tracking down some bad guys. He learns about what Jason has done. Now, in another flashback scene, Jason is waiting outside his mom's apartment with his loaf of bread he's picked up. When the drug dealer leaves, we see that Jason pushes him down the stairs. Batman shows up to confront Red Hood about the death of Tyler's father, and they get into a physical altercation. And we see that Tyler steps in between Batman and Red Hood. And at the end of the story, we have Batman standing there in shock because Tyler's there. And then Red Hood and Tyler hug.
I continue to enjoy this story, Drew. I thought the fight between Red Hood and Batman felt a little bit forced. I didn't totally buy into that. I thought there was a way you could... I definitely could see them fighting, especially Batman coming in pretty peeved that Jason's killed again. I thought there could have been a little bit like have Batman say something first that kind of triggers Red Hood. They basically went straight to blows. That would have been my own. That's a nitpick, to be clear. I thought they could have maybe had the transition to them fighting make a little bit more sense. But other than that, I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, it's not surprising to me that it led to blows, but I understand you saying it went a little quickly because it did.
Right. No, and I agree with you. Them fighting makes sense. I mean, I totally buy that it would turn into that. I thought that there could have been a better, maybe smoother way to make that happen. I don't know. Again, that's a nitpick. It really, I had no real serious issues with this story at all. I enjoyed it.
I did too. And I thought I was fairly on line with the first one. So the second story in this, Oracle in Ghost in the Machine. Oracle has dealings with a hacker named V. Ross who has problems like messing with robot vacuums, smart refrigerators, ice makers, following up on appointments at Gotham Hospital, and messing with people's credit cards. Batgirl had put her away, but she found a loophole and was freed. Barbara decides to make an Oracle costume to make herself more mobile. Her new costume includes smart glasses, earbuds for communication, hidden pin button microphone, telescoping antenna that doubles as a cane or a weapon if needed. She has a mobile server farm, secure alternating mask ISP, holographic sleeve smartphone, stealth Batgirl utility belt, cables in her seams to plug in computers, and then she has generator flats. Now, Oracle goes out to test her toys. She finds out...
Just to cut you off real quick, Drew, for our readers who have not read this comic, I know that sounds like it's very high-tech gadgety. She's wearing a tracksuit. I know they label stuff a lot that seems really like high-tech and stuff, but honestly, if you've not actually seen it visually, she's wearing a very fashionable tracksuit that just happens to secretly have tech in it. But really, she's just going out in sweats.
Yeah. I don't like the costume, but we'll get into that in a minute. Oracle goes out and tests her new toys. She finds out that V. Ross is after old floppy disk. Oracle asks Spoiler to meet her at the warehouse where they expect V. Ross to hit next. The guy that Spoiler and Oracle capture at the warehouse is not V. Ross, and he bites down on an anthrax pill. Oracle and Spoiler find V. Ross at the Gotham Bank, where she is captured. Me personally, I didn't really care for the story that much, and I did not like Oracle's costume.
I didn't mind it. I just didn't like them trying to tell us that it was really a costume. Like, just be straightforward. It's her finding a way to make her sweats be tech savvy. That's fine. I respect it. Why go out in a you know, uncomfortable suit when you can go wear sweatpants and a sweatshirt? It's great. I respect it. Don't sit here and try to tell us that that's a superhero suit, though. Whatever. Honestly, the outfit was fine. It was fashionable. But, I mean, again, they were trying to pretend like it was something it was not. The story itself, I like the conflict, except for the part where the villain was a real person, but they kept pretending like she was like a living computer virus. But she wasn't. She was just a person. And that was the only thing I thought was really confusing. Like, they were like, the story was about like one villain, but it was really, the villain the whole time was really just a girl. You know what I mean? Like, it felt like it was confused on what the villain could actually do.
Well, they were trying to make it seem like the villain was the virus and that Oracle was the antivirus program. I think that's what they were trying to convey.
It didn't really land, I didn't think. It was a flimsy metaphor, I thought.
I'm not going to argue with you on that. Now, I like the fact that they're trying to give Oracle an arch nemesis, but they need to flesh out this character a lot more. Like I said, I didn't really care for the story that much. I thought it could have been a lot better. And maybe it's because they didn't really have enough space to really flesh out the story. But I like the concept of Oracle having an arch nemesis. So maybe they'll play on that more in the future and make her a better villain.
Or pick somebody better. Maybe. Just spitballing.
That too. All right. We also got The Outsiders in The Caretaker, Part 2 of 3. Maseo's mother is angry with Katana for losing his soul, and now she demands that Katana kill the man she is now in love with, Jefferson Pierce, and take his soul. Eh. That's what I thought of that story.
You know, we didn't really like the first one for this, and this did not change my mind. If anything, it honestly made me like it less. There was something at least interesting about the fact that the prison was actually Metamorpho. This one was just kind of dumb. It was like the mother-in-law from Hell story, but with superheroes. I don't know. It did not do it for me.
Me either. All right. And for the last story in this issue, we had the Grifter in the Long Con Part 2 of 5. Mr. Lucius Fox and the Grifter, their car is rammed into by another. Grifter gets out and takes out the guys trying to get them. Lucius goes in an ambulance, but we find out it's Leviathan people, and Grifter ends up shooting them. At the hospital, Cole flirts with a female that ends up being the head of security of Wayne Enterprises and Cole's boss. Mr. Fox has set everything straight with the police. We see that Winslow Shot, the toy man, comes to Grifter, and before they can conduct any sort of business, Red Hood shows up. Grifter and Red Hood fight, and we see that Grifter gets the upper hand. Red Hood wakes up with a note on his hood, borrowed gun plus $100. Then under it, it says, gun return, kept the money. XOXO Superman. And then Red Hook looks next to him and sees the toy man is shot. To me, it felt like...
I was really confused because it seemed to imply that Grifter killed Toy Man, but that didn't make sense to me.
Like, yeah.
If he was going to do that, why didn't he just do that?
I know.
Red Hood wanted to do it. Why would you fight? Why, like, if you just wanted to kill Toy Man, just let Red Hood do it? I don't... So that makes me think that somebody else killed Toy Man, but then... I don't know. That ending, I had to go back and reread a couple of panels of that fight to see if I had, like, missed something. And I really didn't want to do that because I didn't like the story. I did it anyway because I was like, wow, this really doesn't make sense. Let me just make sure I'm not missing something. And then I didn't. And then I wasn't. I was like, oh, my God, I just got suckered into rereading that.
You're not the only one that reread that, because – what threw me off was the XOXO Superman. I'm like, what? And I went back and read it. I'm like, oh, okay, it's Grifter joking. But it didn't make any sense to me why he would borrow Red Hood's gun and kill him. And then, of course, the $100 thing was just a... I mean, he probably took the $100, but he was making a joke. I don't know.
But also, why would Red Hood have $100 on him?
Yeah.
You know, I understand it's a stupid joke and what I not to read into it too much, but like, what? Come on.
The other thing is the last part of the story doesn't really fit with the first part of the story. I didn't think. It's like we had two different stories mashed together.
I would agree. I really have not cared for the Grifter story, so I will admit that I was not invested enough to care for most of it, and I regretted instantly rereading that part. So,
yeah, I'm not really interested in the Grifter either, and we've talked about that before. So, all right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, Superman number 30. Clark, Lois, and John spend the perfect day together playing miniature golf. Superman gets a call from an old alien friend, and Superman and Superboy fly through space to the planet Thakram. Kareth O'Donnell is the ruler of the Thakramites, but Superman finds out from Falder Pornum that he is dead. And we learn that together, Kareth O'Donnell, Falder Pornum, and Kal-El defeated a great monster together. Kareth O'Bacchus is the new king, and Kareth O'Donnell's son. Superman explains that the parent-offspring dynamic here is different. Parents and children see each other as rivals. Now, when Superman learns that Kareth O'Donnell could not have called him, Superman and John take their leave of Thakram. But before Superman goes, though, he wants to see the remains of the one who fell with his own eyes. And John finds an old communicator along with a device that looks like a cage. We find out that Falder Pernum is under the control of alien parasites. Man, I think they wrote this issue just to mess with me with those names.
I'm intrigued by this story. The names are definitely hard to pronounce for sure. But I'm interested. I'm interested in see where this goes. I don't think it's going to be particularly complex or deep, but I'm interested at least.
Yeah, I'm interested in it too because it's different. This story doesn't seem to be on the Kal-El is dying and Superboy is taking over storyline that I haven't really cared for. So far it's been a fun mission with father and son. All right, well, let's move on to our last issue for this week. Wonder Woman, number 770. And I don't know how I missed this, Cletus, because this is actually an older issue. We were supposed to be on 771. I don't know if that has anything to do with me just missing it or it not being posted on DC's website, which is possible because, like we talked about earlier, there's been stuff not posted up there. So when I started reading 771 and I was totally confused. I was like, what the heck's going on? I said there had to be an issue before this and I went back and found it. So anyways, Wonder Woman wakes up on the battlefield of Asgard. Sigur Siegfried, slayer of the dragon Fenrir. This is the afterlife, and Diana learns that in this realm, each night they kill, they die, and they celebrate in the hall. As each new day dawns, the fallen are restored, and they do it all over again. We see that Wonder Woman is killed on the battlefield, but it resurrects in Valhalla, the finest mead hall in Asgard. In this hall of warriors, Diana finds herself feeling strangely at home. Now we see a voice is crying out to Diana, telling her that she is in the wrong place and reminding her she is Diana of Themyscira. We see that Diana meets a little squirrel named Ratatosk, and he takes her to his home, Yggdrasil, a world tree, and queen of the parliament. She's very sick, and when she dies, Ragnarok will happen, the end of all things. Ratatosk states that only Wonder Woman can help. We see that Diana returns to the great battle, but promises Ratatosk that she will return in the morning to help. Diana dies again in battle, and the mysterious person shows up again and tells Diana that she is an Olympian. She tells Diana this realm is on borrowed time. Yggdrasil's death is a harbinger that their time will soon come to an end. Asgard is doomed. Now, Diana discovers that Siegfried and a few others are missing. And when Diana returns to the battlefield to discover that Siegfried's body is there, Ratatosk informs Diana the Valkyries never came for Siegfried, and the Valkyries have disappeared, leaving Sol stranded. Diana agrees to help Ratatosk cure Yggdrasil, and Ratatosk agrees to help find the missing Valkyries. Whew! Another story where I can barely pronounce the names. I found this very interesting, putting Diana on Asgard and why this is happening. It's intriguing.
The first thing I want to say is thank goodness you noticed that we hadn't read this issue, because this was really good. This was an excellent comic.
I have to agree with you. I mean, when I started reading the second issue, I was so confused. I was like, what is going on? And I realized I had missed something. So I'm glad I went back and found it. And I have to agree with you. This was a really good issue.
The art, I thought, was phenomenal. The story is so good. I am so intrigued, like you. What's she doing in Asgard? That's really interesting. Honestly, even if that wasn't a mystery, I would be okay. Like, just the story of her in Asgard doing her thing is interesting enough. The fact that you've got the added mystery on top of that, of like, she shouldn't be there in the first place, only makes it more interesting. But the fact that the story, the base level story that we're seeing on like a page to page, where it's just her, you know, living in Asgard, that's interesting enough in itself. Like, I was just enjoying that.
Yeah, and I wasn't familiar with the writers on this either. So, I don't know if you'd seen them before or not.
I can't remember, but man, this is real good. I'm very impressed. Very, very impressed with this.
Yeah, and we even had a backup story in this that was pretty good. We had a young Diana climbs a tall tree so she can get a view of Themyscira. She trips and falls, but Jumpa, a flying Kanga, catches her. Diana races Jumpa through the marketplace and out to the ocean, where Jumpa throws her off into the ocean. Onun scoops her out of the water and takes Diana to her birthday party. At her party, Diana says she's tired of being just a kid and wants to do more around here. And Diana learns she's going to be a storyteller. Her sisters have decided she's going to learn how to tell the story of Themyscira. I think I like this backup story because the younger Diana, the artwork felt geared for a story like this.
I agree completely. It was the perfect art style.
So, and it was a fun read too. It was a lot less serious than the first story. And I thought it was a fun read for the backup to the story.
I agree. I mean, this was very good. It's honestly, in my opinion, of the big three, it's the best of the three right now.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree with that. So I really enjoyed this issue, and I'm just kind of sad we missed it when it first came around. But we'll be talking. I threw on 771 for next week, so we'll be caught up. All right. Well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our CW shows.
The 42 cast is turning 100, but like all good things, it must come to an end. Tune in to our epic finale as we see who lives, who dies, and who gets their own spinoff. And then come back when the 42 cast is back for season 2, with even more segments, more guests, and more of explaining why Ryan is wrong. It's why we're still the ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything. You can only find all this awesome by downloading the 42 cast, a proud member of the ESO Network.
And we're back. Let's talk Batwoman, season 2, episode 10, Time Off for Good Behavior. Batwoman takes down another distribution center for Snakebite, beats up some False Face Society members, and tells Black Mask over Gotham News 8 she is coming for him. Commander Kane gets attacked in his car by a member of the False Face Society, and when he regains consciousness, he finds that he's been injected with Snakebite. He has a dream that he rescued Beth from Cartwright. Ryan and Mary open up a community center in a bad part of Gotham. A masked man comes in and shoots the place up with a lightning gun. The media are calling him Kilovolt. When Batwoman tracks down the ex-reporter to learn more about Kilovolt, Kilovolt attacks both of them. Luke is able to pull a fingerprint off the weapon and discovers Kilovolt is Michael Castronis. He's been in Edgewater prison for the last 2 years. Roman Sionis comes to see Commander Kane about Snakebite that he found in one of his employees' possessions. Sure, dude, we know why you're really there.
Well, Okay, can we stop there for a second?
Sure.
And talk about, have we ever seen Jacob Kane actually be good at his job? I mean, I know the point of the show is that the crows aren't doing a good enough job, hence the need for Batwoman. But the man must be the most incompetent law enforcement officer of all time. I mean, even if we didn't know that Roman Sionis was Black Mask, the coincidence of both the therapist and him showing up right as he's developing an addiction that helped push him towards that? Come on, Drew. Like, how unbelievably stupid is the man?
I know exactly what you mean.
It's all those things where, like, they're trying to show Black Mask cleverly getting him addicted, which makes sense. I admire the writers for trying to do that. Unfortunately, their solution to that is for Jacob to just be a moron. I mean, why in God's name would Roman go directly to his office and not just drop it off at the front desk effectively? I mean, Drew. Okay, anyway, continue.
Well, the show, before we start back, the show was trying to show that him and Roman were friends or something, or acquaintances, or a little more than just they knew each other. And
then
I think
why have we never seen him before? And I know why, because the actor had never been cast. But you know what I mean? That's the problem with something like this, is the show tries to convince you that this is not out of the norm to happen, except we've seen him on a daily basis, and it's never happened.
Also, the show did show us one other time. He was on the news talking about something. That was the first introduction to Roman. And then they bring him on here in this scene, expecting the audience to know who he is. And I don't think the average person would know who he is. Now, Julia Pennyworth confronts Dr. Rhyme and exposes her as Enigma. Enigma injects her with something and tells her she'll make her forget again. And then the next time Sophie sees Julia Pennyworth, she's moving to Berlin. When Batwoman gets in trouble confronting the contractor building the prisons, Luke comes to rescue her with a lightning gun. We see that Mary reopens her clinic. And then at the end of the episode, Angelique is released from prison and going into protective custody to testify against Black Mask. And the episode ends with the False Face Society taking Angelique hostage.
Alice and Pennyworth are pretty sure that the doctor is Enigma. And yet they choose to confront her individually, in which if anything goes wrong, no one else knows what's happened. Drew, is it a requirement for everybody to be morons on this show? I just don't understand.
Yeah, it is.
I don't have a problem with her not capturing the villain right away. There's no story there if that happens. But, like, come on. Have the characters act with something resembling logic. Something at least approaching logic. Ugh. I just get so frustrated by this show every time. And then it just never gives me any reason to not continue to feel that frustration. I mean, we had another Deus Ex Machina where Luke shows up inexplicably I have to assume, based on what we've seen from this show the last two seasons, Drew, that the Batcave has a teleporter, because I have no idea how they keep getting from place to place so quickly. Luke is literally talking on the radio to Batwoman, and not 2 minutes pass, and he is at the scene with a gun.
I know, it'd be cool to have one of those, wouldn't it?
But they have to, right? I mean, I'm assuming they're just not telling us that they have a teleporter, because they've done this multiple times this season where there's no reasonable explanation for a person being able to get to a scene as quickly as they have, other than that's what's convenient for the plot. And I know that that's nitpicking, but the show isn't doing anything for us to not notice those flaws. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's one thing, like, if the show is really good and there's something that doesn't totally make sense, you might not notice it because you're so into what the show is doing, or everything else is so good, it doesn't really matter that this one thing doesn't totally work.
nothing else, for me personally, nothing else in this show is working. So when I see something that's stupid, it's the only thing I can focus on because there's nothing else distracting me from it. You know, if there was something good or something interesting, I'd be like, ah, well, that's dumb. But Leah, what I'm more interested in what's going on here. Instead, I have no interest in what's going on. So I see something's dumb and then that's all I can think about.
Well, the other thing I want to point out is Batwoman seems to be getting rescued almost every episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She gets in trouble like almost every episode and somebody has to rescue her. It's getting old. Batwoman's supposed to be the hero, not being the one being rescued all the time.
The other thing I wanted to mention real quick, and I'm curious if you noticed this, Drew. This really bothered me more than I would have anticipated. There was a sequence towards the end of this episode where it was just Rachel Maddow talking, as the show does, which is fine. That's fine. But because it's a TV show and we can't just have a blank screen with Rachel Maddow talking, they're giving us scenes from Gotham. I mean, really Vancouver, but whatever. Theoretically, we're getting all of these snapshots of the city of Gotham, but it's cutting and it keeps cutting. And it's theoretically trying to go to the beat of the music, except it's not. So it's not in time with the music. And it was cutting like every half second. It started to hurt my eyes. I know that sounds like an exaggeration, but really, it was uncomfortable watching that scene because it kept cutting for no rhyme or reason to all of these different urban settings with no purpose or point, but it was so fast. It was like the screen was just flashing at me.
I have to admit, I didn't notice it because I was probably typing notes at the time that scene was going on. Because I got to be honest, I've been watching the CW shows on my tablet, and I'll either pause it or if nothing exciting is going on, I'll let it run while I'm typing my notes. And I was probably typing notes when that scene came on. So I didn't notice.
I wouldn't necessarily encourage you to to go back and see it, but it was, again, I know that sounds like a stupid nitpick compared to other stuff, but like it was really bad. I would very much not to like to see that again. Oh, I hope they don't do that. I mean, they were cutting from scene to scene so quickly, and there was no, again, it was not to the beat of the music, although it tried to be a couple times. And there was no rhyme or reason. They were, again, it was, well, we have a 40-minute show and we have nothing visually to go for this slot of time. So here's some stock footage of Vancouver. Oh, man. Please do not do that again, showrunners. That was brutal.
Now, I can tell you, shows like Batwoman and stuff, I will let it keep going while I'm typing my notes. So I might not be looking at the screen, but other shows like Black Lightning or something, I'll pay more attention to.
Well, and in your defense too, Drew, that's the perfect scene to be typing notes because nothing's going on the screen. I mean, again, if they could have, they would have just left the screen blank because really all that was going on was the radio voiceover. There was only something on the screen because there has to be something on the screen. That was really it.
But yeah, that's my new thing this season is watching all the CW shows on my tablet because I can start it. I can pull it from room to room so I don't have to sit out here at my desk and type up notes. As soon as I'm done with a note, I can grab my tablet and go somewhere else in the house. And then if I want to take notes, I'll come back here. Or sometimes I just sit here and watch and do notes at the same time. It just depends on what mood I'm in. But I like watching it on the app because I can pause it like on shows I'm more into. If I don't want to miss anything, I just pause it and then I type up my notes and then I go back to it. But other shows like Batwoman, I may just let it run while I'm typing up my notes. So, and if I need to see anything, I can back it up. So, little secrets behind the show. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Black Lightning, Season 4, Episode 7, Painkiller. Anissa and Grace go on their honeymoon. Anissa goes to pay their bill at the bar And while Anissa goes to the bathroom, Grace gets taken. Khalil shows up and tries to kill Anissa because he still has the kill the pieces order from Odell. And we see the inner conflict Khalil is having. Now, when Anissa wakes up, she can barely move. Anissa tells Khalil to go after Grace and save her. Khalil is able to find Anissa's abductor. After running him over with his car, Khalil runs down a lead that leads him to a room where people are hooked up to laptops. Their brains have been partitioned, and it's some sort of experiment that's going on. We see that Grace wakes up and is able to escape her bonds using her shape-shifting powers. Khalil discovers that a woman named Mia is behind the brain experiments, and he thinks her technology can help him with his painkiller problem. And he decides to rescue Grace and steal the tech. Now we see that Maya sets the self-destruct and leaves. Khalil finds Grace, who has already freed herself, and Khalil tells Grace to go on ahead. Khalil wants to go after the tech, but he doesn't have enough time and leaves. Back at the bar, Anissa thanks Khalil for saving Grace. Khalil asks Anissa not to tell Jennifer where he's at. He's not ready to see her yet because of painkiller. And then at the end of the episode, we discover that Maya is the daughter of Odell. This episode was definitely off the beaten path of what was regularly going on in Black Lightning. Definitely the backdoor pilot to Painkiller.
Well, see, I know technically it would be considered a backdoor pilot because it's taking place in another show's season, but there's nothing, the idea of a backdoor pilot is that you're still watching an episode of that show, but it's also, you know, an attempt to set up a new series. This is just the pilot of Painkiller. It has absolutely nothing to do with Black Lightning, other than obviously it's the same characters. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's totally disconnected. Even the backdoor pilot for Green Arrow and the Canaries made sense within the context of that season. Yes, they jumped to the future and it was dealing with its own plot line, but it made sense within the context of that season because we saw her go back to the future. It made, like, we understood why we were seeing what we were seeing. This was here purely just so that Painkiller could get set up for his own show.
Agreed, because that's basically what it was.
I cannot call it a backdoor pilot. I know technically that's what it is. This was just a pilot being aired as a Black Lightning episode.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
That being said, I enjoyed it, and I am very curious now to see more of the show. The only thing that I was unclear on, and I'm curious what you thought, Drew, it seemed to imply that we were in the future, but not directly stated, so I'm not confident that we were in the future.
I don't think it was in the future because Anissa said last episode that she wanted to take Grace on their honeymoon, and it sounded like they were going really soon, not off into the future.
But then the whole setting and the outfits that everybody was wearing don't make sense to me. You know what I'm like? It seemed like it wanted to be set in the future. I agree with you. There was too much that happened. I was like, I think this is in the present, mainly because I can't imagine Odell would still be alive 20 years from now. It really felt like it wanted to be set further in the future to me, just with the wardrobes, especially Painkiller's. Hit one of his, not the Asian sidekick, but the other guy. Like, what was that trench coat, Drew? Are you seriously trying to tell me that that's a 2021 look?
Yeah, we know it's not.
You know what I mean? Like, I am not fashion. I am not in touch with fashion, but that, come on. That's got to be something where you're trying to make it a little futuristic.
Yeah, and I have to agree with you. It did feel like this city or wherever they're at. I don't even know if they said where they were at, but I got the feeling that it was supposed to be felt a little futuristic myself, and it was in some you know, some other place far away from, so that it was far away from Freeland, maybe not even in the United States.
What it felt like, and I would say it was influenced by it, except obviously these would have been filmed way, way before it came out. It felt like Madripoor from Falcon and the Winter Soldier is what it felt like.
Yeah, I can see that. So, but yeah, this was clearly, like you said, this was clearly a pilot for Painkiller.
Yeah, and my only complaint with that is that it's the last season of Black Lightning, and this in no way whatsoever contributes to the season of Black Lightning. It's good. I'm very intrigued to check out more of Painkiller. I'm hoping it does get a season. But as an episode of Black Lightning, I mean, it's not.
Yeah, it's not. They could have just saved this for the beginning of Painkiller, but I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to grab Black Lightning audience to watch the new Painkiller show. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Supergirl, Season 6, Episode 3, Phantom Menaces. John and Magan discover a phantom came out of Silas. Supergirl and her father try to catch a ride with a phantom, but their plan fails. Supergirl's father is taken hostage, and Supergirl's leg is injured. Now, the old district attorney was fired for losing Lex's case. The new DA is in Lex's pocket. The new DA is now after Lena. We see Silas turns into a phantom creature right in front of John, Alex, and Brainy, and Brainy is able to capture it. Kara makes friends with a fifth dimension imp that knows Mixypilic. Kara learns that she was a princess that was brainwashed by her father. Magan goes after one of the phantoms by herself and gets injured. Lena and Brainy donate Lex's money to the children's wing of the hospital, and Lex has Otis set the children's wing on fire. Lex blames Lena for the faulty wiring because she was in charge. We see that the imp gets her magic back and heals Kara's leg. Alex and Brainy hold the phantom while John transfers McGann's soul to his urn and then back to her body again. McGann is saved. Lena leaves LexCorp to be free of Lex, and then at the end of the episode, the imp shows Kara's The imp helps Kara rescue her father. Kara and the imp come up with a plan to escape the Phantom Zone. Man, I didn't realize my notes jumped back and forth so much. Maybe I should have wrote them a little different.
I mean, the show jumps back and forth, so.
Yeah. And I just took notes as I went along, so sometimes I do group stuff together in my notes, but I obviously didn't on this one. There's a lot of jumping back and forth.
Drew, is every episode this season going to have Martian Manhunter be an idiot in a new way? It's just like he's never been an adult before, and he has to keep being taught a new lesson by Miss Martian every episode. Like, last time, he's so gung-ho, we're going to save her, we're not going to take any precautions, we're just going to do it. And then this one, he learns his lesson, right, at the end of the episode. And then this one, he goes the complete opposite way. Oh, we're going to be very strict and soldierly, because that's what I learned from last time, so now I'm going to take that to the absolute extreme, with no room for gray area. Everybody must be a soldier. And then he learns about halfway through, oh, maybe I shouldn't do that, maybe Alex needs to grieve. And it's just like, what? This guy's like 3 centuries old, Drew. He just, what has he done until now? Why?
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from with that. It is a little silly.
And it's, to be fair, in defense of Supergirl, it is not the only CW show that is guilty of this. And it, honestly, it's one of my biggest gripes. I think a lot of these episodes, again, for Supergirl, for Flash especially, for the past number of seasons for Flash, these episodes are like mini morality tales where each one is like its own little Aesop's fable where Flash learns his lesson by the end of the episode or Supergirl learns a lesson at the end of the episode.
which is a choice. I don't agree with that choice, but it's okay, I guess. But then the problem that you run into is essentially you're suppositing that Barry hasn't learned how to be an adult for 30 years and just somehow miraculously got to adulthood without learning any of the social lessons that people learn while growing up. And same thing here. Martian Manhunter is how many centuries old? And he goes from one extreme last episode to the other extreme this episode. I mean, and yet he was a father figure in seasons before this. So clearly at one point he had the emotional maturity to understand this stuff and then just loses it for the sake of the plot. I wish there was something else that they would hook their train onto. I just don't understand why these episodes need to be morality tales. I guess the thinking is, well, it's for a younger audience, so we're giving this morality tale to a younger audience that doesn't know better. So we're like teaching them these how to be an emotionally mature adult. But like, come on, find a new angle.
We have to blame Crisis on that.
But it was a problem before Crisis. Flash has been like this for a number of seasons, Drew, where it's just that every episode is essentially Barry learning a new way to be an adult because he, again, clearly never learned.
Yeah, I know what you mean about these morality tales, and I really don't want to see that in my shows.
I think it's fine every once in a while. That's fine, but it's every episode. I feel like Supergirl leans on that heavily. Flash, I truly believe, has leaned on that heavily for several seasons now. And we get it in some of the Arrow occasionally would do it. They were a little bit better about making it more of like Oliver trying to get over his trauma and relearn these lessons that he once knew. You know what I mean? Like, I thought Arrow at least approached it better, where it made more sense why he would need to maybe relearn something, because the man spent 5 years, theoretically, we know that wasn't really the case, but theoretically, at the beginning of the show, he spent 5 years not near anyone. So needing to relearn some things, or maybe like retrain his, you know, emotional sensibilities, that sort of made sense for that show. But some of these other ones, I mean, Barry was a fully functioning adult before Flash started. Right. He didn't have the, I mean, yes, he had trauma, but it wasn't the same as Oliver's. He wasn't isolated. I don't know. It gets old, especially because it feels so repetitive. At a certain point, when you do it over and over and over and over and over again, I'm like, how does anybody, I feel like Supergirl is at least allowed to be the hero most of the time. I feel like Flash in year 7 is still constantly learning how to be the hero. And he like simultaneously has the whole team looking up to him and yet never seems to have fully learned the right lesson on how to be a hero and needs to constantly learn a new thing. And it's just like, at what point is he going to get it right? When does the Flash actually become the Flash? Because the show would essentially, I feel like, sometimes has this belief that he's not yet hit it yet. It feels like we're always still just like one episode away from him figuring it out. It feels like we're kind of stuck in second gear, if that makes sense. He never fully hits the like true Flash. He's always like almost the Flash.
I know what you mean. Cause we don't see it really, but he should be more of a leader with that team, and he's not.
Well, everybody will call him a leader, but then we so often see him not doing that or being a poor leader. And yet everybody then like, oh my God, but your love is this all-time thing. And my God, Barry, you've taught me how to be a better man and all of this stuff. And yet we constantly see the exact opposite of that. And like, who exactly are you looking up to? Because showing is better than telling. And you keep telling us that him and Supergirl and Batwoman are these just phenomenal beings. And God, we all need to just look up to how great they are. And then they just screw up and they screw up and they screw up. And that's fine. I don't need them to be perfect beings. But all we ever see them do is screw up and then turn around and the show tells us, but how great are they? I don't know. They kind of seem like idiots half the time.
All right. We went from Supergirl to Flash.
Well, but really, I'm really talking about all of these shows, because I really think it applies to all of them.
Yeah.
Even Superman, Drew, that show, I am enjoying that one the most out of all of them so far. But even Superman is like learning how to be a parent, and his kids are high schoolers. What was he doing for the first 17 years?
He was off on missions.
But you know what I mean? Like, even that show is about Superman learning how to be a parent, except his kids. That makes sense, Drew, if his kids were toddlers. They're high schoolers. He's been doing it for 15 years. What the heck was he doing?
Yeah.
That's my problem. It's all of them. It's not just The Flash. It's not just Supergirl. It's all of these shows have these heroes learning lessons, which, again, is fine every once in a while, but they're learning lessons that as functioning adults, they should know.
I understand. All right, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Flash Season 7, Episode 7, Growing Pains. The episode opens up with Barry having breakfast with the Speed Force. Oh, and Iris too. And I noticed Barry called her the Speed Force while Iris called her Nora. Now we see Barry's powers are glitching. Barry gets called to a crime scene where a driver has been killed with ice powers and some tech was stolen. Kramer shows up and blames the attack on Killer Frost, even though Barry's analysis of the crime scene show the opposite. A warrant is issued for Killer Frost's arrest, and Kramer is also offering a $100,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest of Killer Frost. Frost figures out that Mark, the bartender, is the new villain. Mark stole back the chip he built for Ivo Labs, and Mark is a cryogenicist. He tricked Frost into going to an abandoned warehouse so he could get a scan of Frost so he could replicate her powers. And now he's Chill Blaine. Frost and Chill Blaine battle. Frost takes him out right before Flash and Allegra show up. Flash puts the cuffs and a bandage on Chill Blaine. Kramer and the Metahuman Task Force show up and ask Killer Frost to surrender. Killer Frost surrenders. Barry apologizes to the Speed Force and calls her Nora. And Barry and the Speed Force are ready to take on the other forces.
What a phenomenally stupid subplot. Oh, so good. Glorious. What I personally didn't appreciate, and I could be wrong, and maybe the show does intend to do something with this, was I understood before we know Chilblain is Chilblain, and he's just hot bartender, I understood the romantic subplot between the two. But when he's revealed to be a psychotic killer, right, slash stalker, essentially, and yet the show still chose to have sexual undertones during their fight, I felt personally uncomfortable with that, Drew. I don't know about you, but I was like, wait, what are we doing? Are we essentially saying that just because the guy is hot, Frost is still going to be attracted to the guy even after he's revealed that he's a creep? Really? Yeah.
I thought that was weird too, and it doesn't really fit in with the times. You know what I mean?
No. Oh my gosh, it doesn't. That's the thing, Drew. I was like, oh my god, are you kidding me right now? That's something you could have gotten away with, you know, a couple of years, 5 or 6 years ago. But, oh, what? I'm actually honestly really surprised that the crew went along with that choice. Oh man, poor choice. That's subjective. You don't have to agree with that. But man, I was like, what are we doing here? Really? Just because the dude's hot, we're still going to have Frost be attracted to him? Yeah, the dude's a creep. The dude is like a no doubt, clearly a creep. Come on. I did not like that. The other thing that we talked about, I won't get too deep into this. I really do not like the Speed Force being personified like this. Is just, I agreed with Barry, Drew. The show was giving us what was essentially, the show was telling us Barry was making the incorrect argument, right? That he was wrong. And I agreed 100% with what he was saying. He's like, everybody's treating her like a person, but she's not. She's a force of nature. I was like, yes, 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 she is. It's not Nora. It's the Speed Force. I was agreeing completely with him. And the show was like, and Barry, you're wrong. And I hope that you feel bad that you're wrong. And I was like, what? The man's right. He's the only one on this whole damn show that has any sense right now.
I felt exactly the way you did, because I was like, oh, good. Barry's just, you know, not treating the Speed Force as a person. We get to the end of the show. I'm like, really? Really? Barry's not the one that's wrong here. The Speed Force is not a freaking person. These other forces aren't freaking people. And the show definitely wants us to...
The show isn't personifying these other forces. You're exactly right. The other people that we've seen are the Flash, essentially, of those forces. They're the person that's been imbued with that power. The only one that we've seen actually personified is the Speed Force. Why? Why? I just don't understand.
The other thing about it, it feels freaking creepy.
I do not like it. I really, really do not like it.
I don't know, but the Speed Force was acting really creepy in this episode, I thought. Always showing up where Barry was at, and, you know, I don't know. It just felt weird. Almost like the Speed Force was trying to be a second wife to Barry.
Slash mom.
Yeah. I mean, just weird, huh?
I do not care for it. I do not care for it. I don't need a force of nature to have feelings or human emotions. I don't need to be able to relate to the Speed Force, Drew. I'm okay if I don't relate to that. I don't need to relate to a bolt of lightning either. You know, just in case the show felt the need that I needed to have a human connection to every single thing on the show, the next time Cisco takes a drink of coffee, I don't need to relate to that cup of coffee on a personal level. It can just be a cup of coffee. It's okay. I'm okay with that.
Oh, man. Yeah. Speed Force being Nora in this episode was just felt really weird. And we know it's not going away anytime soon.
No, I know. I think that's the thing that's getting me really worked up is because I don't like it, but I know that it's not going anywhere. So then all I can do is shake my fist at this guy. I can't do anything about it.
Well, you'll have to worry about it for a few weeks because Flash has gone on hiatus till May 4th.
Great.
So. All right. Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Yeah. So one of my coworkers just was talking to me about what a huge fan he is. He just recently discovered the Harley Quinn animated show, which we've mentioned before, was on DC Universe and now is on HBO Max. And he loves it. And he was telling me, man, one of my favorite characters on this is Kite Man. I didn't even know he was a thing. And so I had to educate him on Kite Man's greatest, in my opinion, greatest appearance in the War of Jokes and Riddles, which is secretly Kite Man Begins. So in honor of, and I actually didn't know Kite Man because I've not seen all of the animated series yet. Kite Man was in the show, but. Yeah, if you enjoy Kite Man and that, and you haven't read War of Jokes and Riddles, check it out, because the secret subtitle of that is Kite Man Begins.
All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out congratulations to Ashley Pauls and her husband for adopting a baby girl, Lizzie, who's now 3 weeks old. So congratulations to them.
Yeah, that's awesome. Congrats.
All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got the next Batman, Second Son, Superman Red and Blue number 2, Catwoman, Justice League, Nightwing, Flash, and Wonder Woman. And of course, our CW shows. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
waiting for you and the power you possess. In your satin tights, fighting for your rights, and the old red, white, and blue.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.